things.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a chemical spill in West Virginia has contaminated the water of hundreds of thousands of people.
The president and prime minister of the Central African Republic resigns amidst increased fighting between Christian and Muslim groups.
Students at Jefferson High School stage a walkout and take over North Killingsworth Street in support of teachers.
Good. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 10th, 2014. I'm Keegan Herron.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Several hundred students from Jefferson and Wilson High Schools walked out of classes this afternoon to support their teachers in their ongoing contract negotiations. Portland teachers are facing a potential strike in the coming weeks as negotiations this week failed to come to an agreement. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was on the scene at today's student walkout and brings us the voices of the teenagers who organized their peers in support of their teachers. Students marched and chanted, "We're the future of this nation. We deserve an education."
They've blocked Killingsworth. They're stopping in the middle of Killingsworth. Carol Smith, rich and rude, we don't like your attitude. That's in reference to Carol Smith, the superintendent. So why are you out here today, Olivia?
Because they're trying to put more people in the classes, so it's going to be harder for us to learn, and they're trying to cut down our teachers' checks, so they're trying to, pay the teachers less for more kids. So we're walking out and fighting, and the district doesn't really care. And they're trying to abuse the teachers, but we're not going to let that happen.
Our teachers are in their contract negotiations with the district. And, you know, their working conditions are our learning conditions. So if the teachers are getting cut short, so are we.
So I feel like this was just a big step for us to support our teachers, because they support us every day that we come to school. And like we talked about, our anatomy class is 40 deep. And so we just wanted to support our teachers because this is what they do for us. And so this is just us giving back to our community, giving back to Portland Public Schools in general.
Strike affects, the teachers a lot, just because, you know, you're taking time out of your work, but especially for the kids that need an education, we're not going to be in school. For the kids that are on 75% reduced lunch or free lunch, this could be the only meal that they're going to have. So when you have times where you're not going to have kids in school at all, you're taking away the meals that our kids need to eat and what we need to survive. School at one point is not just education, it's surviving. And at this point, we need to push education past surviving and into learning how to build a successful life in our community. And so I think that is what we are trying to do here today.
Supposedly they're making progress, but we really want to put pressure on the district to say, stay at the table, do not force our teachers to go on strike, because that would hurt us.
That was our biggest thing, is to get this set in stone and, you know, move a step forward and just come together as a school and as Jefferson to make a big turnout that people didn't expect us to do. And so that was our main goal, and I feel like we kind of accomplished.
Mic check!
Mic check!
On Monday!
On Monday!
January 13th!
January 13th!
At the school board!
At the school board!
We are going to rally!
We are going to rally!
That was Jamie Partridge from KBOO at the rally at Jefferson. What do we want from the district? Stay at the table is what students chanted as they blocked Killingsworth Avenue in North Portland this afternoon. They walked out in support of their teachers, who remain without a contract after negotiations this week ended without an agreement. The most contentious issues are the district's plan to lift a cap on class sizes and a plan to require teachers to pay the full cost of their health insurance premiums. The school board is scheduled to meet this Monday, January 13th at 6 p.m.
A Clackamas County Circuit Court judge dismissed a case that reserves use of Oswego Lake to shareholders of the Lake Oswego Corporation and denies access to the public. The City Council adopted Resolution 1212 just after local activists affiliated with the Occupy movement announced plans to stage a demonstration from the lake in 2012. Plaintiffs Mark Kramer and Todd Prager contested the resolution, claiming the body of water meets the criteria to be designated as a navigable waterway and therefore publicly accessible, according to state law. Kramer and Prager contended that since the state owns the land underneath the lake, the city's legally obliged to ensure public access because the lake meets the criteria to be designated as a navigable waterway. We attempted to reach Kramer to see if there are plans to appeal the decision, but he was unavailable to respond before deadline.
Roughly 1,400 couples were married in Utah beginning on December 20th when a federal judge declared Utah's ban on same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional. The ruling was put on hold Monday when Utah's Supreme Court gave in to requests from Utah state officials to put the federal court ruling on standby. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced on Friday that same-sex marriages legally performed in Utah will be recognized by the administration and will be eligible for federal benefits. Utah's Republican Governor Gary Herbert announced on Wednesday that the state will not recognize these marriages, although they were legal at the time they were performed.
Poet, educator, and activist Amiri Baraka passed away in Newark, New Jersey, last night at 79 years old. Baraka held the honor of being the last poet laureate of New Jersey. The state revoked his title after Baraka wrote a poem entitled "Somebody Blew Up America" in reference to the bombing of the World Trade Center. Amiri Baraka wrote the book Blues People, chronicling the rise of African American music in the United States, in addition to countless poems and essays. He also played a large part in the 1970 Black and Puerto Rican Convention, after which Ken Gibson was elected as the first ever Black mayor of Newark. A tribute to Baraka will air tomorrow at 2 p.m. on KBOO.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. This evening features an interview with Sherry Sakognagi, a health coach and personal trainer, on what and why we eat the way we do. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. This weekend's weather calls for a 110% chance of rain, with highs in the low 50s and lows in the low 40s. The moon is waxing gibbous. Sunrise is at 7:50 a.m. and sunset is at 4:47 p.m. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 30 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 42. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 30 CPM with a high of 53. Powell Butte measures 27 CPM with a high of 50. And in Raleigh Hills, the radiation count is 30 CPM, high of 52. Seaside, Oregon has 32 CPM, high of 47. Hanford, Washington has 29 CPM with a high of 54. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 33 counts per minute with spikes of up to 55. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
5:12. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
For generations, picture takers have instructed their subjects to say cheese. Well, no people say cheese better than Wisconsinites, who unabashedly wear cheesehead hats in public, celebrate dozens of cheese festivals, have a Monterey Jack bacterium as the state's official microbe, and generally honor the milk curd as a deity. So naturally, Wisconsin would be the state to come up with the idea of spraying its city streets with cheese brine. This is not some sort of cheesy tourist promotion, but an actual attempt to have two problems blend into one clever solution. Problem number one is ice. Wisconsin gets lots of it, with Milwaukee alone averaging more than 4 feet of snow each winter and spending some $10 million a year to apply rock salt to clear its frozen streets. Not only is that a lot of money, but about 30% of the dry salt bounces off the roadways and pollutes waterways. Problem number two is cheese brine. It's a waste product from cheese making, and this state produces nearly 3 billion pounds of cheese a year, so it has lots of brine. It costs a typical dairy farmer thousands of dollars each year to dispose of it. But this winter, farmers are donating their waste problem to cities like Milwaukee, which are hauling the brine to their road maintenance facilities and blending it into the rock salt. The idea is to create a mixture with just the right stickiness to keep the salt from bouncing away. You want to use provolone or mozzarella, says a Milwaukee Public Works manager. Those have the best salt content. You have to do practically nothing to it. This is Jim Hightower saying, voila, two messes equal a neat solution. Wisconsin officials still consider their cheese-coated streets an experiment, but it seems to be working out just fine. And it's just one example of a myriad of innovative alternatives being produced by local governments all across our country.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Legislation that would expedite the passage of sweeping free trade agreements has been introduced in the U.S. Congress. The Trade Priorities Act, or TPA, would give the president increased power to expedite passage of trade treaties with much less congressional input than other legislation. Some have nicknamed the legislation NAFTA on steroids, as it comes on the 20th anniversary of NAFTA being signed into law. Groups such as Public Citizen have voiced their concerns about the lack of public involvement and governmental transparency in the negotiation of the trade agreements. The legislation would allow the president to put future trade deals on a so-called fast track to speed them to passage without significant congressional debate. The bill comes at a time when the president is trying to pass several trade agreements, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement. Proponents of these trade agreements include Walmart, Pfizer, Boeing, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, all of which have lobbied heavily for their passage. Opponents say that deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership give corporations more rights than sovereign states, and that they should be debated fully rather than fast-tracked.
The U.S. Senate has not approved an extension on unemployment benefits after Senator Harry Reid pushed a last-minute change that ended up costing him some of the few Republican backers of the bill. If the Republicans in Congress get their way, billions of dollars will be cut from food stamp programs, and hundreds of thousands of unemployed Americans will lose their unemployment benefits. Renowned activist and intellectual Noam Chomsky summed up the state of American politics in an interview on Huffington Post Live.
Now, as far as the refusal to provide very minimal living standards to people who are caught in this monstrosity, that's just pure savagery. There's no other word for it. I think one of the major successes of the Occupy movement was to place the issue of inequality pretty firmly on the public agenda. Of course, it had been a very serious problem that's been growing for a long time. Inequality now is at a level not seen at least since the 1920s, maybe before, maybe farther back. And it's very severe. Practically all of the growth in recent years maybe I think 95%, has gone to the top 2% of the few percent of the population. The real wages, you know, wages measured by, qualified by inflation, have stagnated or declined. A large part of the wage of the working population is now actually living below the poverty line. And and as we mentioned before, there are tens of millions who just can't get work or have part-time work, not real work. And meanwhile, at the very top of the wealth spectrum, there's enormous wealth concentrating. Corporate profits, as I said, were just booming in this tremendous wealth. So sure, this is a major problem. In fact, it's even a simple economic problem. It's cutting back economic growth. These people who are, it means that ordinary people, the mass of the population, can barely consume, which of course cuts back economic growth. You mentioned the minimum wage. The minimum wage is way below what it ought to be. The minimum wage should, up and through the 1950s and the 60s, the big growth period of the American economy, minimum wage pretty much tracked productivity. And so the more productivity of labor increased, the more the minimum wage increased. If that had continued, the minimum wage now would probably be, I don't know, maybe way over two times as high as it is. Part of the neoliberal assault was that the minimum wage in real value started declining, not declining, but not growing. So as the GDP, the economy grew, and as productivity grew, the minimum wage stagnated. So it should be raised considerably, probably doubled or more. It's a shame that this has taken so long even to be a discussion. As for support, we may recall that the last major program for helping families that are at the level of survival was undertaken by Richard Nixon, the Earned Income Tax program, which was quite significant. And that should also be increased in many respects. Nixon was the last liberal president. In fact, many of his programs are now being dismantled or are under attack. This is what's happened in the past generation.
That was Professor Noam Chomsky speaking today on Huffington Post about the current state of inequality in the U.S.
The U.S. economy added a meager 74,000 jobs in December, according to government data released Friday morning. This was the weakest pace of job creation in 3 years, and less than half the 200,000 jobs that analysts had expected. Even so, the unemployment rate dropped to 6.7%, due mostly to fewer people looking for work, which also surprised economists. The large number of people who have been out of a job for 6 months or more continues to cast a shadow over the labor market. There were nearly 4 million long-term jobless in December, virtually unchanged from the previous month. The poor jobs report will add urgency to efforts in Congress to reinstate unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed.
A chemical spill from a coal mine in West Virginia has contaminated the water supply of 300,000 residents. The leak came from the mining company Freedom Industries and spilled into the Elk River early Thursday morning. The chemical is known as methyl cyclohexane methanol, or MCHM, and is used in the process of washing away the impurities commonly found in coal. Short-term exposure to MCHM is known to cause irritation to eyes and skin, as well as rashes and difficulty breathing. Long-term exposure can severely damage vital organs. In response to the spill, both the state and federal governments issued a state of emergency, ordering those in the affected area to avoid any contact with the water. Convenience and grocery stores quickly ran out of bottled water as the demand skyrocketed. Schools and restaurants have been closed as well, with no date set for when the water will be safe to use again. The privately owned water treatment plant on the Elk River is usually able to handle small amounts of chemicals in the water, but the spill quickly overwhelmed existing facilities. the federal government has authorized the transport of trucks of bottled water into West Virginia from Washington, D.C. The National Guard will be deployed to distribute the water.
Earlier today, Michael DeJotobia, the president of Central African Republic, announced he was resigning. In tandem, the country's prime minister also made public his resignation. Jotobia came to power less than a year ago in a coup that replaced a predominantly Christian government with a Muslim government. Although he was the leader of the Muslim Seleka rebels, once in power, his authority largely vanished, as his pleas for peace and a ceasefire have gone ignored. To combat the violence from the Seleka rebels, many of the country's Christians formed a group calling themselves the Anti-Balaka, who took it upon themselves to fight against the Muslim rebels. Thus far, over 1 million people have been forced to leave their homes to avoid bloodshed. Neighboring leaders have been concerned about the violence that has already killed over 1,000 people, spilling into other countries. The UN Security Council wants the African peacekeeping forces to increase their presence in the country to 3,500 troops, on top of the 1,200 French troops currently stationed there. Without a clear head of the government, it remains unclear what the future holds for the Central African Republic.
A 4-year-old child has been shot to death by United States Marines in the Helmand province of Afghanistan. Reports claim that low visibility due to dust in the air caused Marines to believe the toddler was, in fact, an enemy combatant, and thus fired even though they could not see what they were firing at. Responding to this, the Karzai government called for a unilateral cease of operations in villages by the International Security Assistance Force, the group responsible for training Afghani soldiers and NATO troops. The U.S. wants the Karzai government to allow some U.S. troops to stay beyond 2014, as per the bilateral security agreement, which has been on the table unsigned for over a month now. NATO officials promised the case would be investigated. Also in Afghanistan, human rights groups report that child hunger is on the rise in the war-torn country. Childhood malnutrition has gone up 50% since 2012. The ongoing war in the region also prevents people from getting to clinics when they need medical attention.
A new panel appointed by the president to expedite the release of prisoners from Guantanamo Bay has announced that the first inmate in the review process has been recommended for transfer and release. Mahmoud Mujahid, who has been held without trial since 2002, will potentially be sent to Yemen. This will also be the first prisoner released to Yemen since May 2013, when the United States lifted its moratorium on releasing prisoners to Yemen. Prior to this, the U.S. government has considered Yemen to be too unstable and unable to integrate former prisoners back into society. However, the Obama administration is relaxing these rules in an attempt to make good on its initial promise to close the illegal prison during the president's time in office. The new panel is assigned to review the prisoners on a case-by-case basis in an attempt to determine if they can be released. Currently, there are still 155 inmates at Guantanamo, of which almost two-thirds are Yemeni. Mujahid will join 55 other Yemeni men already on a list marking them as approved for transfer, although this does not necessarily indicate they will actually be released at any particular time.
The second of three Navy football players accused of raping a female classmate has had the charges against him dismissed. This announcement comes as a new report by the U.S. Defense Department found that a culture of disrespect among military athletes is still fueling sexual assaults, which are on the rise in academies. Despite the increase in training and disciplinary actions in all of the military branches for sexual assault, the crime is not being taken seriously among some athletes. The assault cases include both female and male victims. The willingness of victims to come forward to report assaults since new legislation took effect last month signals an increase in actual reprimands and prosecutions of perpetrators. The director of the Navy's sexual assault program, which includes the Marines, said that the increase in reporting indicates that more service members are starting to understand what types of behavior constitute harassment or assault. Although sexual assault is not new, the recognition of this type of behavior among service members is new. There is a move to restrict alcohol sales at the military bases after reports that drinking is responsible for a large percentage of the incidents reported. Congress has already made changes in the military justice system, requiring a civilian review if commanders decline to prosecute a case. The new legislation increases victims' rights and strips the military commander's right to overturn a jury conviction. Even though new programs have been instituted in all branches, the number of actual incidents, ranging from unwanted sexual contact and harassment to violent assaults, has remained essentially the same.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamie Partridge, Terry Eaton, Robin Ryan, Carl Fisher, Kristen Yount, Robert Barncord, and Keegan Herron. The producer is Keegan Herron. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 100.4 let me say that again, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterland.
And I'm Keegan Herron. Coming up on Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on More Talk Radio, Cecile and Celeste host a discussion about student support for Portland Public School teachers who are in contract negotiations with the school district. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus presents Trees in Paradise, Part 2, as host Barbara Bernstein speaks again with Jared Farmer, whose book, Trees in Paradise, explores the connections between the transplanted people and trees that have shaped the landscapes and cultures of California. And at 11, Health Watch features an encore presentation of an interview with botanist, nature photographer, and writer John Collis, founder of Wild Food Adventures. He discusses his book, Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate. Thank you for listening to KBOO Radio, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. You can become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for Counterspin. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Keegan.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with the KBOO Evening News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the 50th anniversary of the launch of LBJ's War on Poverty is generating a lot of press coverage of an issue corporate media tend to mostly ignore. But what's missing from those conversations? We'll ask author and professor Stephen Pimper. Also on Counterspin today, in the wake of successful marijuana decriminalization efforts in Colorado and elsewhere, pundit opponents of pot are forcefully objecting. New York Times columnist David Brooks says he smoked when he was young and it wasn't so bad, but let's continue criminalizing it. And Fox's Bill O'Reilly says marijuana, texting, and video games are sending our youth down an escapist road to ruin. We'll be joined by Columbia University neuroscientist Dr. Carl Hart for a very different view. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's news.
Media are turning their attention back to Iraq with the news that Al-Qaeda-affiliated fighters have taken control of the city of Fallujah. That has caused media to recall the history of the Iraq War, but only part of it. U.S. troops fought to pacify that area, according to the Washington Post. NPR referred to, quote, the bloodiest combat since Vietnam to retake the city of Fallujah from Iraqi and foreign insurgents, close quote. Other news stories tallied the precise number of American troop deaths there and wondered if they had died in vain. But this is only one part of the Fallujah story, what it meant mainly for U.S. soldiers. The other part of the Fallujah story is quite different. That city was the subject of a massive siege and subsequent invasion by U.S. troops in 2004, which included the use of cluster bombs and white phosphorus weapons. Hundreds of civilians were killed. Most of the buildings in the city of Fallujah were destroyed. There are continuing investigations into the public health effects of the U.S. attacks there. That is the part of the Fallujah story that is not being told by media outlets, that can recall certain aspects of the Iraq War very clearly and forget other things entirely.
ABC's This Week featured a year-end segment on December 29th presenting short profiles of 2013's